From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Jennifer Mitchell with the news on This Day in Maine, Wednesday, February 24th, 2021. Last night.
You know, there's never been a better time than a Maine winter night to look up at the stars.
Governor Janet Mills began her State of the Budget address last night with a call for perseverance and an extolling of Mainers' hardiness. She touted her administration's ability to cut costs during the pandemic without heavily impacting services. And she proposed more than $100 million in bonds aimed at preserving the state's post-pandemic economy. She called the budget proposals straightforward.
They have basic goals. To beat back the pandemic, keeping Maine people healthy and saving lives, to fund education, and to maintain a stable economy and get people back to work.
Those proposals include expanded support for child care, worker training, broadband access, and heritage industries like farming, forestry, and fishing. Republican Senate Minority Leader Jeff Timberlake responded for his party. He said it was good to recognize the state's successes and struggles, but also stressed the need for greater legislative involvement in response to the pandemic.
I think two heads are better than one, and I think we need to find a way that we can be part of the discussion and part of how we move Maine forward.
Timberlake also says that the physical distance between lawmakers is making it difficult to reach compromise on important issues. High school seniors whose education has been disrupted by the pandemic could be granted alternative diplomas under a new bill before the legislature. The bill's sponsor, Democratic Representative Rebecca Millette, says that the pandemic has drastically affected the lives of high schoolers, from hybrid and remote learning to housing instability and hunger. She says her legislation would allow some of those students to apply for an alternative diploma over the next 4 years if they're unable to meet their local school's graduation requirements.
This bill, as amended, is one potential tool in our toolbox and will be especially important for those that simply cannot meet their local school diploma requirements despite best efforts of all involved.
The legislation has received support from several educational groups and the Maine Department of Education. At a public hearing last night, conservationists and fishermen alike roundly criticized federal regulators' proposed changes to fishing rules designed to protect endangered whales from fishing gear. Fred Bever reports.
With roughly 360 North Atlantic right whales left on the planet, the government is moving to reduce the risks of serious injury or death from entanglement with rope that lobstermen and other fishermen use. Under consideration are measures to require the use of breakaway links in the ropes, more traps per line, and seasonal fishery area closures when whales are traveling or gathering in areas off Massachusetts and possibly Maine as well.
We truly want the whales and all sea life to prosper, and I mean that, but we also need our coastal communities to prosper too.
Yarmouth lobsterman Brendan Strong was one of many who joined the online hearing to say the federal rulemaking process is flawed, based on poor understanding of both whale behavior and potentially dire effects on fishermen's businesses and safety. He argued that the true danger comes from ship strikes, illustrated by the relatively small number of right whales found dead in 2020 after the pandemic shut down the cruise ship industry and limited cargo traffic as well.
Two right whales died in 2020, neither from entanglement. How can I willingly sacrifice my operation to accept deadly regulation changes when there is no proof that the regulation changes will help right whales?
Scientists say even one death a year would lead to extinction, but several conservationists also argued that the proposed rules would be ineffective because they rely on old data, overly rosy estimates of the species' survival rate, and they say the proposed seasonal closures aren't as long or big as they should be. Zach Cliver, a longtime Bar Harbor Whale Watch leader and marine scientist, says there is evidence that more than 80% of the right whales have been injured by trap ropes, while hundreds of other types of whales have been entangled along the eastern seaboard.
And it points to the crisis situation that we're in and that we've been in for a long time.
And Cliver says the proposal to add more traps per trawl line could prove dangerous.
I do not support any of the trawling up provisions in this DEIS. because they add more traps and weight to each end line, and I believe they make them more lethal.
Much of the discussion focused on so-called ropeless lobster fishing technology, which allows traps to be located and retrieved using remote control systems. Conservationists see that as the ultimate solution, but some acknowledge it needs more work, and they say the new rules should provide better incentives to encourage fishermen to help develop it. But many Maine fishermen scoff at the idea, and Marine Resources Commissioner Patrick Kelleher agrees it's not practical for Maine's diverse fishing grounds.
Seems the agency is moving in the direction of species protection with no care about collateral damage.
Kelleher testified that the Fed's push toward ropeless fishing gear could lead to the total closure of Maine's lobster industry. Federal officials hold a second online public hearing on the proposed rules tonight. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
Well, Heather McGee is an author and speaker who says that racially discriminatory laws and practices negatively impact everyone. And she's got some economic data to back that up. McGee's newest book, The Sum of Us, examines that economic impact. And on Thursday, she'll deliver the keynote address at the Maine Center for Economic Policy's 2021 Policy Insights Conference. And she joins us now ahead of that conference. Welcome.
So glad to be with you all.
So when did you realize that, I guess, economic data was a key to examining the effects of racism on everyone?
You know, in many ways, it happened sort of in reverse order. I spent nearly 20 years trying to bring research, litigation, and advocacy to our big economic problems, to poverty wages, to the lack of health care, to the crisis of student debt, to unaffordable housing. And it wasn't until I realized that racism was playing such a strong role in our politics and in our policy making, that I realized racism was driving inequality for everyone.
So what sort of economic indicators are perhaps the most telling? Like, where can you really see the story of racist policy kind of unfolding?
Well, you can take it from the biggest macro level. Citigroup did a report last summer that calculated that if we had closed the Black-white economic divides, which were created by public policy and can be fixed by public policy, 20 years ago, our country's economy would be $16 trillion richer. So that's zooming way back, the biggest scale of numbers. And it makes sense, right? If you have so many of the players on your team on the sidelines because they're saddled with debt and don't have enough opportunity, of course, your team is not going to score as many points as you would if your whole team, all of the players, were able to get on the field. And then you look at the very small kind of kitchen table issues, like the issues of student debt. Public college used to be free because the government picked up the tab. And that was the case back when 90%+ of the college-going population was white. And over the past 40 years, as our students have become more diverse, governments have cut back on funding public colleges. The federal government shifted from free grants to loans that you have to pay back with interest. And now we have a stealth privatization of our public college system, which was the best in the world and which was a great investment in all of our economic gains. And we have $1.5 trillion in student loan debt. That impacts 8 out of 10 Black students who have to borrow because of the racial wealth divide, but it also affects 6 out of 10 white students who also have to borrow. And it's just a bad public policy decision to have this debt for a diploma system. And I see the fingerprints of race in the politics behind it and in the policymaking.
So a moment ago, you used the word team. And I'm wondering, is that part of the problem, though, that we think in teams and that we have different ideas of who we want on our team or who should be on our team or who's a valued member of the team?
Yeah, I think that the core idea that I really like to interrogate in my book is the idea that we as Americans are not all on the same team. When I talk about the team, I mean all of us, the sum of us, which is the name of my book. But what I discovered at the beginning of this journey that I took to write the book was that many white Americans, an increasing number, have this zero-sum worldview. And it's something that is a story that is sold and marketed when you hear language like makers and takers, taxpayers and freeloaders, the idea that progress for people of color has to come at white folks' expense, the idea that a dollar in my pocket means a dollar less than yours. That's something that is not economically true. In fact, the opposite is true. The more that we invest in working and middle-class people of all races being able to meet their basic needs and live out their dreams, the more rich and prosperous our entire economy is, the more stores open, the more schools are well-funded, the more economic activity we have in our communities. And yet that fear of scarcity is something that has really driven politics and policymaking. So much so that if you take the issue of healthcare, white Americans are the largest group of the uninsured. And yet the closest we've come to universal healthcare, the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, was very associated with a Black president. And so the majority of white people disapprove of the Affordable Care Act, even though the ideas in it, Medicaid expansion, staying on your parents' health insurance to your 26 pre-existing conditions, are kind of non-controversial ideas. And yet the whole package has been so racialized that it's caused the majority of white people to oppose it, even though they're the largest group of those who have to go without health insurance.
It seems that there's sometimes been a habit of viewing racial inequity and racial problems as a Southern problem, and Northern states sometimes struggle with the concept that their histories and policies have had negative racial impacts as well. What trends have you seen in New England states like Maine, you know, that kind of hit that intersection of race and economic consequence?
Yeah, this is such a good question. You know, it was interesting. Maine is the whitest state in the nation right now. It's the state whose children are the least likely to go to school with someone who is not white. And it is the state that had the largest Ku Klux Klan outside of the South, mainly to terrorize Catholic immigrants at the turn of the century. It's also one of the only Northern states that refused to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. And so it joined most of the states in the former Confederacy in really having a government that said that, you know, healthcare for working class people is welfare and we don't want it.
So folks take away one message from your keynote on Thursday, you know, what would it be? What's the takeaway message if people had one thing to remember here?
That I think the takeaway is that it's not a zero sum, that we can link arms across lines of race and culture, frankly, the same way that, you know, many Mainers did at the turn of the century when the immigrants of the day were Franco-Canadians. And if we do so, then we will be able to unlock these solidarity dividends that can offer gains to everyone.
Author and speaker Heather McGee, she'll be giving the keynote address at the Maine Center for Economic Policy's 2021 Policy Insights Conference on Thursday. Taking a look at the weather now with meteorologist Paul Cousins.
This day perhaps prompted the first saprain across southern portions of the state, and now a highly energized low will rip across northern Maine overnight, encouraging snow over the northern half of the state, according to 3 inches along and north of routes 2 and 3, 3 to 6 inches across the mountains, Ashland, Holton North, most at higher elevations near Jackman. Farther south, just a few brief showers and clearing by dawn. Windy late, 16 north to 33 along the entire coast. Arctic air will become reestablished across only the northern third of the state tomorrow. Partly sunny north of mountains, flurries evaporating, mostly sunny for the remainder. Quite windy, especially in coastal York County. 20 in the St. John Valley, 34 Bangor, 42 Scarborough South. Friday, lovely. Moderate breezes, plenty of sun for nearly everyone. 20 to 39 north to south. Saturday, north and east, some sun early, but skies will become overcast statewide, with afternoon showers south, snow showers spreading east across the northern half during the afternoon, 37 to 45 north to south. Sunday, another surge of unseasonal warmth will arrive. This is meteorologist Paul Cousins.
And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org. And join us tomorrow morning on Maine Calling at 11 o'clock, where the topic is the psychology of virtual communication. I'm Jennifer Mitchell.